Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. You can get pretty much anything tractor-wise, mower-wise, handheld. They've got it all up there. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, right between Pine Grove and Oasis Boulevard off-ramps. And or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. And like I say, you can go up there and get parts, service, sales. They do it all up there. And or you can get them on the web. Their address is papemachinery.com.
Ta-da! Well, I guess I'll reiterate, actually. How about that? WeThePeopleRadio.us is the website. Today is March the 3rd, 2024, and we hope that you will take these programs that we've been doing for 13 and a half years and share them with friends, family, whomever. We do this to provide an audio library for people. It doesn't cost money to listen. The website is easy to figure out. We have topics. I've done a lot of topics on a lot of things on marijuana, China, environmental stuff, government, national security, veterans. Did a really lengthy series on South Africa, Islam, just all sorts of things. And if you have topics that you would like us to cover, we're always happy to go find some experts for you so you can hear from people that you wouldn't normally have access to in the, I don't know, you know, you see people interviewed for a minute or a minute and a half, you don't learn anything. So we try to have longer conversations with folks. Today's second hour here is about ESG. Our guest, Paul Tice, has written a book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. I think we all kind of think this, but we can't prove it. Because that's not our field of expertise. This is, however, his field of expertise. He's worked on Wall Street for the past 3 decades, and he teaches. He's got an MBA in finance. It's just all sorts of things going on with him. I don't know how much of it he wants to share with everybody, but he's got the cred, and I posted it online for you if you'd like to see. But I want him to tell us about this race to zero, because it's becoming really clear that ESG is not helpful.
No, it's not helpful. And I think a lot of people have heard the term ESG. They don't really understand what
true.
It is. And so they just kind of sit back, and a lot of this just happens around them. And we're not really doing a lot to stop it. But thankfully, Mr. Tice will inform us and let us know exactly what is ESG and why he wrote this book,
All right,
The
got
Race,
the,
Race to Zero.
Got the floor there, Races to Zero.
Okay. Hi, Aaron. Hi, Bill. It's good to be with you guys.
Sure.
Let me give you the 2 second on my background just to give you a feel for where I'm coming from. So I worked on Wall Street for 40 years. I retired a couple of years ago, and roughly the first half of my career was on the sell side. The second half of my career was on the buy side, and the major firms I worked at over the years were J.P. Morgan, Lehman Brothers, and then BlackRock. And for the past 30-plus years, I have specialized in the energy sector, both as a sell-side analyst and as an investor, and that's given me kind of a front seat to this whole ESG movement, which is targeted all on climate change and then the energy sector in turn. And then, as you mentioned, I've been teaching for the last 10 years down at NYU Stern, which is my alma mater. So I wrote the book mainly because, to your point, no one is really talking about this, what's going on in the financial markets. People are kind of aware. There has been, you know, increased pushback the last couple of years, But no one has ever actually given an insider's view, having worked on Wall Street. And there's a reason for that. You're not allowed to have a divergence opinion about this. You're not allowed to criticize. It's a very totalitarian approach in terms of ESG, and, you know, it's a problem when you disagree with the CEO who's telling you this is what we're going to do. So I thought it was important to kind of articulate why ESG is such a bad thing, and I do think there is a silent majority on Wall Street that will agree with this once they read the book. And I also, I think, tactically, I agree with some of the approach of certain people, politicians and others, in terms of how do you attack ESG. You know, I think we need to keep the focus on climate change and the defunding of oil and gas, which is the main objective of ESG, as opposed to being distracted by some of the more cultural issues and woke issues that have been attached to the movement. Not to minimize those, they're obviously serious, but I think climate change really is the priority around ESG, and the other side will tell you that to your face.
Yeah, it's all about climate change, and the funding tactics that the banks and the financial institutions are using are going to reshape things if we don't get a handle on this. And this has been happening in Europe for quite some time. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think Europe is you know, obviously the leading edge of a lot of these UN-led verticals, if you will. So climate change, sustainable development, and also ESG investing. All of these movements are intertwined. They're really three legs of the same stool, and they're being led by the United Nations. And if you look at who are the strongest champions of that, it's the European member countries of the UN. Mm-hmm. And that's also true when it comes to financial regulations that are going to impose this ESG approach on all financial institutions. So, you know, Europe is you know, showing us, you know, what's in store for the U.S. unless we can reverse this.
Right.
But it's all intertwined, and you can kind of view it. I think it's important to, you know, again, you know, the first step towards solving a problem is acknowledging you have a problem and the scope of it. Yeah. And, you know, the other side has a 40-year head start on us in terms of pushing this agenda. And in the book, I trace it all the way back to the 80s. And you can even go further back because you can view ESG as kind of just the latest anti-capitalist movement that goes back 200 years. You know, the idea of reimagining capitalism, you know, you're basically replacing it with something else. You're not, you know, modifying it, no matter what you call it. So I think we need to have that in mind that, you know, they've got a 40-year head start on us, and they're committed to it. There's a lot of vested capital here. People have made careers on this, so they're not going to give up, you know, willingly. So I think that needs to color our tactics going forward.
Now, you mentioned in your book, too, that even though it has been really taking hold in Europe, the United States is kind of fighting back a little bit on this. In fact, you mentioned BlackRock. I heard not too long ago that they were kind of trying to get out of the whole ESG thing because of the devastation that it's leaving in its wake. It's not investor-oriented, so to speak.
Yeah, I would throw headlines like that BlackRock is backing away from ESG is under the category of fake news, honestly.
Oh, really?
I think what we're seeing is kind of a tactical retreat by some of the leading advocates in terms of Wall Street firms. So obviously, Larry Fink has been, you know, the spokesman has been most vocal about sustainability in ESG, and that's led to targeting of him in particular by a lot of the Republican states and the attorney generals. And then you've seen over the last couple of weeks, BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard and J.P. Morgan have announced that they're withdrawing from some of these net zero alliances, which have been set up, and they basically are meant to defund the oil and gas industry. But, you know, I think that's, you know, withdrawing from those net zero clubs is clearly because they're concerned about antitrust litigation. and rightly so, because it's very easy to sue them based on, you know, the tenants and the membership in that group. So that's why they're retreating. I think they will still vote the same way and act the same way. So I think we need to keep that in mind. And I think when Larry Fink says, I'm not going to use the word ESG because it's become politicized, you know, he's not changing the behavior of the firm. I think they're just waiting for air cover from the regulators. When the regulators, the SEC, the Fed, the FDIC, the Department of Labor, when they finalize all the proposed rules that they're working on right now related to ESG and climate, then everyone will have to follow it, whether you're a believer or not. So I think a lot of these true believers, though, are backing away from it because, again, they don't want to be the target. But as you mentioned, some of the backlash that BlackRock has experienced, it really hasn't been that painful. In 2022, a lot of the Republican states pulled money from them, if you remember, and it was about $4 billion of assets. But in that same year, which was a down year for the market, the firm had more than $300 billion of net inflows, completely dwarfing whatever was taken out by red states. So, you know, it's going to take a lot, given the, you know, the business model and the size of BlackRock, to do damage to them. And I think it's somewhat misplaced, because even if you got BlackRock to really back off from it and say, we're never going to do this again, it's not going to change the fact that regulations are coming to force everybody. No one's following Larry Fink's lead on sustainability because they think it's going to lead to better returns. Everyone is kind of doing it, whether they believe or not, because they're afraid. And if they speak out, they become the next target.
Right. Right. So
that's a terrible way to make decisions on how we invest, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah. Give us a kind of a snapshot on how ESG works, and as far as the financial markets and how it affects the, or how they are affecting who the winners and losers are.
Sure. So just get the definition. So ESG is environmental, social, governance. These are non-financial factors. And the argument is that they should be used to drive corporate policy and investment portfolio decisions, as opposed to objective financial metrics.
Which is, you know, lunacy on the face of it.
I'm sorry?
And which is just lunacy on the face of it.
Right, right. I mean, again, this is why they've not allowed anyone to criticize it, because it would be obvious truths that you would point out immediately. So these are morally subjective, non-financial factors. And the argument that they're making is, if you focus on these things, the people working on Wall Street, eventually it will create financial value for you over the long term. They never actually define how long that long term is, and you never actually get to that horizon. But that's kind of the premise of it, which is ridiculous on its face. And, you know, it's predicated on the theory of stakeholder capitalism, which has been mainly championed by the World Economic Forum over the last 50 years, which says that, you know, you need to run companies not for the good of their owners and their capital providers and their employees. You need to run it for the good of society, for people and planet, as they say, which, again, that's a ludicrous concept. I mean, most CEOs don't really have that skill set to solve the world's problems. And then, obviously, it's really, that's the domain of governments, in terms of fixing those bigger issues. And it's not capitalism. I mean, stakeholder capitalism may be the end stage of capitalism if we don't turn this thing around, but it's basically government-directed capitalism, which the last time I checked is basically fascism. And you can actually trace back a lot of the language and the structure and the argument here to the 1930s in Germany and Italy.
Yeah, one of the lines in your book under returns and ESG performance art, which I thought was a great title for the chapter. You say the long term investment horizon is never actually defined. Like the actual horizon is something that is always just over the next hill and forever out of reach. And that's so true.
Yeah, I mean, and there's been no shortage of research pumped out by business schools to try and prove that premise looking at historical data,
mm-hmm.
that an ESG approach will lead to, that it's basically a positive catalyst for performance. And they've had studies going back to 1970, and then they've rolled them forward. And, you know, I think most of the research you can, you know, basically throw in the same category as Bigfoot sightings, because they all kind of have the same conclusion. It's like, well, we see something, we're not quite sure what it is. You know, if only we had better visibility and data.
Yeah.
So we have to keep on looking, because we know the truth is out there.
And we have to believe.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You got to believe, like in the X-Files. So all of them, you know, kind of fall in that category, less than persuasive. The other problem with them, I mean, there are two inherent problems trying to prove it. One, I worked in the markets in the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s. No one talked about ESG during those decades. No one talked about moral investing, really. So they're trying to prove basically that, you know, everybody in the market was doing this, but they didn't really know what they were doing. But ESG was still having an impact on positive performance that no one saw, even though the financial markets are efficient, right? So that's kind of a crazy argument that they're making.
Well, but, and the idea that when you hear moral investing, I mean, it's almost like they were investing in what, child trafficking or something. I mean, that's not the kind of moral investing I think most people, you know, they wouldn't want to support things that were horrible. But I think a lot of this stuff is unproven and subjective and yeah, Bigfooty. I wish I had a Bigfoot song, darn it. I have to take a really quick break here. And
sure.
We'll be right back with our guest, Paul Theiss. His book is fascinating, and you should definitely get yourself a copy. The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. Someone finally wrote a book about it. Yay. We'll be right back. We'll talk to him a little bit more. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. I'm sure we're the ones who brought you these policies of ESG.
Right out of California.
Just tell me, did they start here?
The birthplace of lunacy.
No. Guest is Paul Theiss. His book is The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. It's a book filled with facts. What a clever idea. A book filled with facts. So, finish your thought, Paul, before you're so rudely interrupted by Free Enterprise.
So the other ridiculous premise of the argument that ESG leads to better returns is that even if the historical record proved it, and you could point to some past performance that was positive, going forward, they're completely changing what the focus has to be with regard to ESG. It has to be all focused on climate change and getting to net zero, decarbonizing, and none of that we've experienced historically. So that's uncharted territory. And, you know, I think we know how that ends. And that's one reason for the subtitle of the book in terms of, you know, the ominous forecast unless we start, you know, changing this thing. You know, shifting away from fossil fuels based on a politically driven transition. It's not based on science. It's not based on market demand. We can't complete it as dialed because we don't have the technology to do it.
No.
And we've gotten glimpses of the unintended or, you know, perhaps intended consequences of going down this road in Europe and parts of this country already because, you know, our electric grids are getting more unstable. You know, if we have bad weather in the winter and they go down, people die like we saw in Texas. People will have lower living standards. Poverty will increase. We'll have less economic growth because fossil fuels has been the driver of capitalism for the last 200 years. That's the reason why ESG and all the activists around it are so focused on getting to net zero. It's a way to control and basically shut down oil, gas, and coal. And you can see what they're doing to coal in this country already. So that scenario, that macroeconomic scenario of net zero is negative, and it can't be positive for the financial markets, right? So that is basically the point around cratering the financial system. And no one in the market really talks about that fact, which is striking to me. Because clearly the outlook will be negative for the financial markets. It can't be positive right now because, you know, we're electrifying the entire economy here as well as in Europe, and we're becoming more dependent on intermittent solar and wind. And the only way to plug the difference there is if you have demand management, which is a polite way of saying you could have power outages, you know, targeted at specific customers.
Yeah, you can use it between 1 and 4, but after 4 and 7, you got to, you know, light a fire. No, and you know, a good example is what we're seeing in the EV industry right now. I mean, look at a lot of our major manufacturers are kind of backing away after losing billions of dollars in this electric vehicle market because we're not ready for it. We're not set up for it. Our infrastructure can't handle it.
Well, they told people in California not to charge their electric vehicles because the grid couldn't take it.
Yeah, and what are we, 3% of the vehicles on the road right now, and they want to go 100% by 2035 or some stupid thing? It can't happen. I mean, a child can see that is a bad idea.
Not Greta Thunberg.
Well, we're going to talk about the youth movement, but they're definitely picking winners and losers, and their big target is oil and gas right now, and I mean that's having a big impact on everything.
Yeah, I mean that's the other piece of the negative scenario is that if you know, it's just the law of economics. If you defund oil and gas, they're not going to have the capital they need to grow. You will constrain supply in this country and in the developed world, and that's going to lead to higher energy prices. And everyone knows that higher energy prices feed into everything, mm-hmm. particularly food prices. So it's going to make the inflation of the last 2 years basically look like child's play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and when you talk about the oil and gas industries being impacted, one of the big things that I don't think a lot of people realize is the fact that these companies need to go to banks and financial institutions for capital. And they're a dirty word right now. They're not getting the money. So when they say, oh, we have all these oil leases that are available, they're just not taking advantage of them. Well, they would if they could, but aren't they being really impacted and restricted by a lot of these regulatory agencies and financial institutions because they don't want to be involved in that type of industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the energy industry, it's kind of a pincer approach by Democrats. And you know, we should be upfront that ESG is progressive politics masquerading as finance.
Right.
And so when the other side tries to shut you down by saying you're just being political if you criticize me. It's like, no, we need to embrace that this is a political issue and not be afraid to speak out. So it is all Democrats that uniformly line up with the ESG agenda, similar for climate change. So I think we should be upfront about that. So, you know, Democrats, you know, particularly now when they control the White House, you know, they use an all of the above approach. And during the Obama years, he also used that. But I think that was a cynical phrasing on their part, because when he said all of the above, it kind of implied that he was okay with fossil fuels being alongside, you know, renewable sources and letting the market decide. Now, when Democrats say all of the above, to my mind, that means they're going to use every means that they have, regulatory and legal, to shut down oil and gas. And clearly their behavior shows that. So you've got now ESG in the finance markets used to defund it, but then you also have a lot of the other regulatory agencies passing new rules to kind of constrain them, claw back land from them, so there's less drilling activity. So, you know, just a short list that we've had. We have a methane tax now in this country, which started at the beginning of this year. They have paused LNG export approvals by the DOE. And, you know, I think after this election, if we have to deal with another Democratic term, God forbid, then and that's going to lead to a moratorium. And then you can see all of the regulations that are being passed, federal and state level, with regard to not producing internal combustion engine vehicles anymore. You know, we have that problem here on the East Coast. And then the regulatory agencies are not allowing you to have gas infrastructure in your house. So they're going after furnaces. They're going after stoves. They're going after generators. So this is all kind of a choreographed, coordinated effort to box in the industry. But on the financing side, to your original point, this is already happening, and people are not focusing on it. The number of European banks that will no longer lend to oil and gas continues to grow. It's roughly 10 right now. And eventually, the U.S. banks will fall in line.
Do you think they will fall in line? Do you think they really believe that this is a doable program?
The problem is, and this, I think, is a dynamic to recognize around Wall Street, when you work in a regulated industry, it's very tough to push back on the government. And I think with Wall Street, the history since the global financial crisis has made the industry completely subservient to the government. And you see what happened during the last 10 to 12 years. Right after the crisis, they were blamed for everything, even though, you know, clearly there was a government policy issue around subprime mortgages that kind of infected the entire system. But the industry was sued. You know, they paid out billions. They have millions of more hours of compliance that they have to deal with now. And then the Fed came in and left interest rates at zero, which kind of made the everyone in the market kind of dependent on government for their market cues, right? And that went on for a prolonged period. And I would argue it still, you know, persists to this day, even though we've had, you know, some return in terms of normal interest rates. But everyone is expecting the Fed to always just bail out the market by dropping interest rates again. And we have that same dynamic right now. So I think the industry, it's very tough to speak out if you're regulated. And so I wouldn't put it past a number of these banks to maybe capitulate. If you look at a Wells Fargo, which has had clear governance issues over the years, they have an energy lending business. Would they throw that over the side, you know, to pick up brownie points for the regulator or the public? You can't rule it out. I'll give you an example of one that I was surprised, actually, that capitulated. But a couple of weeks ago, Barclays, which is the UK bank, came out with a climate change statement, which basically just lays out the roadmap that they're not going to be lending to oil and gas anymore. You can read between the lines. And so they succumbed to the pressure from activists over in Europe. But Barclays bought Lehman Brothers. They bought the U.S. broker dealer back in 08 for a song, I would add. And with that, they inherited the energy banking franchise from Lehman Brothers. So they were a major, probably the major European bank that was still involved with oil and gas in the U.S. And they have capitulated. So I wouldn't rule it out for anybody. And even at J.P. Morgan, you would say that they are the leading oil and gas lending company, and they would never go. But their asset management side internally, is, they withdrew from that net zero. You know, they have their sustainability policies there. It's going to be tough for them to reconcile that internally. So it's tough to handicap whether a CEO just doesn't want to have to deal with this grief in the remaining years that they have running a company. You know, that's a tough personal calculation. So, and I think generally speaking, a lot of CEOs don't have the courage of their conviction. Even in the energy sector, where you know that they're coming after you, a lot of the energy CEOs have not been speaking out, I think, strongly enough to defend themselves and the industry.
Mm-hmm. Do you think with a new administration, if we went with a conservative administration, they can turn this around, or are these regulating agencies just too strong now to turn the ship?
No, I there's always hope. So the book was not meant to be a downer for everybody. So I think we just need to start focusing on, between now and 2030, things I think will become more aggressive on the other side, because 2030 is a real date for climate change and sustainable development and ESG. You know, by 2030, they want to have a sustainable global financial system and all that entails. So I think after 2024, which is an important election year in this country, obviously, but actually worldwide, there are a lot of important elections here. Depending on how those ballots go, you may have the declaration of a global climate emergency as early as 2025. Mm-hmm. And the body language has clearly been there from the UN and from the International Energy Agency. So that may give them more emergency powers like we saw during COVID, and maybe that was the template to use under the threat of climate.
Right.
So we'll have to see, but I don't think all is lost. I would approach the book from a Dickensian approach. This is the ghost of Christmas yet to come unless we change our ways.
Right.
That's the way I would look at it. So there's still time.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to have smart tactics right now, and starting with the fact that we shouldn't be afraid to speak obvious truths about what's going on in the financial markets with ESG, and also climate change. I think, because if you can finally address the climate theory and all these regulations that have now come into place through non-democratic means, that will take out everything from ESG. Because away from climate change and net zero, ESG is basically just a bunch of progressive wants over
right.
the years that they've somehow rebranded as sustainable goals for business and investing. Everything else will blow away in the wind, I think, if we succeed on the climate front. So, we haven't had a referendum in this country on climate change, where it's serious and whether we want to undertake what's involved. It's just been implemented behind the scenes through regulatory agencies and through the judicial system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we need to focus the attack going forward, and I think it's going to require government resources led by the red states, honestly.
Right, right. No, you're absolutely right. It's the environmental approach, I think, is what we need to concentrate on, and it will, I think, make the rest of it kind of fall away once we take a position and get in the right direction on this whole global warming or climate change or whatever they're calling it now.
Well, I mean, we have scientists that are being demonized for bringing up science. Now we have economists and people in the financial sector being demonized for bringing up facts.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to hear when we come back, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I would love to hear what the response has been to your book from maybe outside the smart people you deal with, just from the rank and file out there. What sort of heretic are you? We're going to have to change our show called The House of Heretics, I guess. We love interviewing heretics. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Compliance.
We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore, no more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance.
Back with our guest Paul Tice. Okay, so Paul, who's on your camped on your trail here, probably trying to get you fired from your job?
Well, I mean, the only way I could write this book was because I retired from my last job 2 years ago. So cancel culture is real, and you know, I kind of experienced that over the tail end of my career, because you know, as I wrote more publicly in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere, you know, I was basically kind of running on a fairway in terms of being able to express my views. And so I think there's a lot of that going on, which is one reason why you haven't heard from a lot of people criticizing it. There was one story, article I was writing just talking about that dynamic on Wall Street, the fact that, you know, analysts can't speak up against it. And I couldn't get anyone, obviously, to go on record to give me a quote, but it was even tough to get people that I know give me an anonymous quote, because they thought, you know, they would backtrack that they knew me. So, you know, it's a very totalitarian, yeah, pressurized system, and, you know, people, you know, are not comfortable speaking out. You know, I was lucky that I was at the tail end of my career. You know, I was kind of getting tired of not being able to speak up. So the first thing I did was write the book after I left. And I think most of the, because this dynamic is still out there, most of the feedback I will get will be through private text messages, which I've already gotten, that people agree with me. So it's still going to be tough to get public voices. But I think by writing the book, I think there's strength in numbers. So hopefully this, you know, makes more people comfortable to speak out and say, yeah, this is ridiculous. And then over time, you know, maybe we can use that so that politicians, you know, will also get a stronger backbone and kind of lead the charge here. What I did in the book, you know, again, because I think climate change is the main focus here around ESG, the second chapter kind of goes through the entire argument around the so-called science and the problems with the data and all the fatal flaws that you have in the argument. And I approached it from a layman perspective, just so people are comfortable that everyone can have an opinion on this. You don't have to be a so-called scientist in order to have an opinion on it. And even the scientists who have a contra opinion on it are not allowed to speak up. So that tells you that this is really not science, it's more of a religion, to your point about heretics. But I think more people are speaking up, and hopefully, you know, that builds. And then I would argue that people should kind of take that confidence that they have speaking out about it, and again, pressure your lawmaker to do more, because, you know, honestly, we're 40 years into this, and we should have been pushing back on this a long time ago. But I think the Republicans really, at least at the federal level, haven't just had that strength of will. Hopefully at the state level, where you're actually challenging state economies for oil and gas producing red states, that's enough incentive for them to take the lead. And they already have started that. You've seen the beginnings of that. We just need to continue.
Yeah. One of the chapters in your book, chapter 9, is called The Children's Hour.
It's Bill's favorite chapter, by the way.
I got a kick out of it because it's so true. How the movement is using the youth as a weapon to advance their socialist moves. Talk to us a little bit about that. From Greta Thunberg to George Floyd, I mean the whole youth movement is, I don't know, it's particularly irritating to me how we're told that we need to take our cues from children because they know more about this than we do, and it really kind of frustrates me a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think it immediately shows you how intertwined this is all, because, you know, they've been using this hiding behind young people to push the climate agenda, and they're using the exact same tactics now when it comes to ESG. And it's basically a means to shut down the discussion.
Right.
Because you can't reason with children, as we all know, parents among us. So, and you can see that they put them out there, they just spout off, like Mao's Red Guards, about climate change. And, if you let them actually keep on talking, you can see how uneducated they are, sadly. I mean, the problem with, skipping school on Fridays to talk about climate change is, you're missing your education, which I think is the issue with Greta Thunberg. But it's the same dynamic with ESG. They use the argument that, well, you better focus on this if you're working in asset management, because millennials will eventually have all the wealth in the market, and they care more about this than you do. And I think that's a valid point, or something we should be aware of, because of the indoctrination that has taken place in this country for the last 40 years. So if you're a millennial, you were born in 1980, all you've been exposed to, during your education, K-12 or the universities, has been climate change ideology. And by the time you left college, you've got that ingrained in your mind along with gravity as a scientific given, right? And I see that teaching at the graduate school level in terms of some of the adults that I teach. So that's unfortunate. It's going to take a while to break that down. But these people are now moving into the business world, working on Wall Street, and so it's perfectly logical for them, in their corrupted minds, that, oh yeah, businesses should be focusing on climate change and all these other social and environmental issues. That's perfectly normal, right? And it's just a matter of one or two generation turns before, there aren't enough adults in the room and the decision makers are of this mind. So
yep,
we need to be focused on this right now. The argument that millennials, they currently control a de minimis amount of financial assets in the system, but when all the rest of the baby boomers, including myself, are no longer here, all of that accumulated wealth will be passed down to millennials. So that's where they will have control of all the assets in the market. So another point that we need to get on this right away, while we're still kicking, so that we don't have that problem down the road. But I've seen that at the back end of my career, working with younger analysts, that they just have a different mindset, and that's unfortunate, because ESG is not an analysis.
No
matter how you slice it, it's not investment analysis. It's basically using a morally subjective prism to allocate capital, and all of those ESG factors are not determined by people in the market. It's determined by activists outside of the market. So it's removing the agency of everyone working, either for a business or for an investment manager.
Right. And I don't think it is fairly representing the actual investors who expect a return on their dollar. And this is what they're getting, is all this ESG stuff and, children, dictating, where we should be investing our money in the long term, that over the horizon thing that we just never seem to be able to find. It's very frustrating.
I think it would be good for a lot of people on the ESG side to read Lord of the Flies.
I'll
bet you you
could.
If you presented that to 10 millennials, they probably wouldn't know what you're talking about.
They should have read that Atlas Shrugged while they're at it, too. That also did not turn out well.
Yeah, actually, and I kind of touched on that as a theme. It's interesting because energy is a big theme within Atlas Shrugged,
yep.
But it's energy of the mind there, and progressives, I think, are taking it literally. And so all the horrific scenes in that novel about society shutting down, you know, when you're not drilling for oil or the trains don't run, I mean, that's their dystopian vision with ESG, right? You're going to deprive the economy of fossil fuels. It's altruism, you know, pretty much what Ayn Rand warned us about. You know, corporate altruism is basically ESG in a nutshell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of living through that novel right now, and the other side just is not self-aware enough to realize that.
Well, if you inflict enough pain, they'll come around, and that's never a good philosophy at all.
Yeah.
No, I don't disagree, and hopefully it doesn't come to that. But, you know, I think back to you, what can we do? Obviously, if we get a Republican in the White House, which looks like it'll be Trump, that's going to be a key win, because if we can keep the U.S. as a ESG-free country and financial market, I think it will collapse the whole global system, because it's a prisoner's dilemma. Everyone
sure.
has to, like, buy into it mm-hmm. and suspend disbelief. Otherwise, the whole system doesn't work.
Right.
Because, obviously, it's going to subjugate your particular economy. So everyone has to do that. So, you know, if the Republicans retake the White House, I think that's a good first step. But we need to do more than we did during the first Trump term, because we have to push back and go after, again, not just the financial regulations that are now coming on the ESG and climate front, but all the climate regulations that we're dealing with, a number of which were passed, you know, extra legally. So, you know, the Paris Agreement was never approved by the Senate. You know, it's
no,
illegal,
we're not bound
frankly,
by that.
In this country.
Right.
Right? The Sustainable Development Goals for the UN. Again, a treaty never approved by the Senate. So they need to be submitted to the Senate. They won't pass because it requires a supermajority, and that should take the legs out from a lot of this movement. And then if we have to go after the endangerment finding, which was the EPA under the Obama administration, which basically decided that carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases were regulated pollutants, that decision should be with the Congress. That was the case for the first 40 years of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And so it needs to be kicked back to Congress. And clearly that was a political decision that was rushed within 9 months of Obama coming in. So, you know, there are a lot of things that we can go after. I think if Chevron, that decision, which comes down in the next few months, is worded properly, it'll give us more ammunition to go after some of these executive actions, which, you know, I think have had, you know, this deference, you know, invisible shield around them unfairly, you know, up until now. So.
Do you think if we do are able to reverse some of this stuff in the United States, and other countries see that, hey, they're, you know, they're leaving us behind, or they're being more successful, do you think that's going to be enough to change the mindset in Europe? Because I mean, they've got to change as well. And I think some of the things that are happening over there with coal and you know, wind and solar and all this, I think are starting to kind of crack the paradigm a little bit, that this wind and solar thing is the answer. But do you think with the United States making the change to go back to a more reasonable energy solution will be enough to change Europe?
Well, I think it will put them out there on their own. And so they will sink or swim based on their own policies.
Right.
I think it's important to note, too, around ESG, as with climate change, this is basically a two-tiered system where the industrialized world has to adhere to all of these restrictions the developing world, including China and India, don't.
Yeah.
And that also applies to ESG.
Right.
Even though I would argue that companies in India and China and in the emerging markets are a lot more risky than public companies in the U.S. or Europe. But that's the opposite world that we're living in with ESG. But if the U.S. can carve itself out and not comply, then Europe will sink or swim based on their goal to be the first net zero continent.
Right.
That is going to lead to deindustrialization. You've already seen that.
Well,
the European economy hasn't grown in a decade.
No.
Sure. And it's like how the Canadians come here for surgery all the time. So we're busy imploding our own medical system so we can be like the Canadians somehow. Yeah, go figure that out. Our guest this hour is, we're going to make him come back. We're going to hold him as our hostage at some future time. Paul Theis, you are super, super interesting, and we appreciate you coming on with us. Please go out and get his book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. There is much more to discuss with him in the future. Thank you, Mr. Theis, for being on with us.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me. I appreciate it.
There ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.